we're talking about forgotten women, and nobody, no role should ever be forgotten in history.
From Wyoming Public Media, this is The Modern West. I'm Micah Schweitzer. This time we'll hear about strong women of the past. Later in the show, we'll learn about the 19th century laundresses who kept soldiers' clothes clean on the front lines. But we'll start with an Osage woman named Molly Burkhart. In the book Killers of the Flower Moon, author David Gran explores a series of violent murders of Osage Native Americans. The Osage became extremely wealthy in the 1920s after oil was found underneath their reservation. The Osage tribe became very wealthy in the 1920s after oil was found underneath their reservation. Then, dozens of Osage members started turning up murdered in a vast conspiracy meant to redirect their wealth into the hands of white men. Molly Burkhart was stuck in the middle of it all as her family was picked off one by one in an attempt to gain oil money from the Osage. Wyoming Public Radio's Caroline Ballard talked with the author to learn more.
I, like many people, was unfamiliar with the story until somebody had mentioned it to me and this part of history. And I made a trip out to the Osage Nation in 2011. And I made a trip to the Osage Nation Museum. And when I was there, I saw this great panorama photograph on the wall, which was taken in 1924. It shows members of the Osage Nation along white settlers, and it looked very innocent. But I noticed that a portion of the photograph was missing, and I asked the then museum director what had happened to that part of the photograph, and she said she had decided to remove it because it contained a figure so frightening. And she then pointed to that missing panel. She said the devil was standing right there. She then went into the basement and brought up an image of that missing panel, and it showed one of the conspirators, one of the people who had killed the Osage. And for me, I just kept thinking about that fact that the Osage had removed the photograph not to forget what happened, but because they can't forget. And yet so many people, including me, had no knowledge of this history. And that's what really began the project and kind of galvanized me to do it, to kind of fill in those blanks that was a part of our history.
Coming in as a white man who had no knowledge of this, how did you make sure that the Osage voice and history and memory was present?
Yeah, a large part of the book is told from the vantage point based on the records of one woman named Molly Burkhart, who was a really astonishing Osage woman. She was born in the 1880s in a wigwam speaking Osage. Within a few decades, because of the oil money, she's living in a mansion. She has white servants. She's married to a white settler. And her family is being targeted one by one by this conspiracy. Her older sister, Anna Brown, disappears one day in 1921. Molly looks everywhere for her, and Anna's later found in a ravine. She's been shot in the back of the head. Molly's mother, soon after, grows mysteriously sick, and within a couple months has died. Evidence would later indicate that she had been poisoned. So within 2 months, Molly had lost both her mother, her older sister, and she had a younger sister named Rita, who moved into a house near Molly. And one day at about 3 a.m, Molly heard a loud explosion. She gets up, she goes to the window, and she sees this large orange fireball rising in the sky, and somebody had planted a bomb underneath her sister's house, killing her sister's husband, and an 18-year-old white servant who lived in the house. I tell all that because Molly was at the center of what was transpiring, and yet in so many of the official accounts, her story was kind of not told. What it felt like to be her, what that experience was like. And so for me, it was very important to try to tell that Osage perspective, to tell Molly's perspective, and make sure I recorded it as faithfully as possible. I wish I'd found even more records, but I spent many years trying to make sure that that part of the story was told, because that part of the story was often missing from the official counts.
The stories you write about, especially your books that you really delve into the research for, are often filled with mystery and with tragedy. The Killers of the Flower Moon, in particular, exploring that racism and greed. With all of this mystery and tragedy, you know, first off, are you all right? And second off, you know, how do you stay upbeat?
Well, you know, In dealing with the social injustice, for example, like with killers, and I do write about a lot of tragedies, but I find a great deal of inspiration in these stories. I mean, Molly is an inspirational figure. She is someone who kind of bravely and defiantly crusaded for justice at a time when her perspective was often being neglected because she was a woman, because she was Native American, and often amid great danger, often putting a bullseye on her back. So I find, you know, even amid the kind of sinisterness that is happening, somebody who is amazingly inspirational. And even in a story like this, there was a man named Tom White who was a early lawman who pursued the justice often very quietly amongst great danger. And so I find in these stories, I mean, The Killers of the Flower Moon is a story about evil, but it's also a story about goodness. And that goodness is important to hold on to.
Looking at a case that's 100 years old and the difficulty that there was in seeing things for what they were back then, really only putting the pieces together in hindsight, having a vantage point of history, can we harness any of that hindsight to our advantage today?
Well, I think we can't understand the present unless we understand the past, because the past reverberates and informs it. And for example, I don't think you would understand the protests at Standing Rock over the Access Pipeline unless you understand the Osage case. And after my book came out, I met an Osage who had served in the U.S. Army. He was a veteran. He received a Purple Heart. And during the Standing Rock protests in North Dakota over the Access Pipeline, he had walked all the way, or nearly all the way, from Oklahoma to North Dakota, which is a long way, especially when you've been wounded in the knee very severely. And he told me during that walk, he had thought about the Osage murders. And the particulars of what was happening nearly 100 later is different in many ways. The Sioux didn't have oil. They weren't getting wealthy from the oil. But as this Osage told me, that the issue was still fundamentally the same, which was about the rights of American Indians to protect their lands.
David Grant is a staff writer at The New Yorker and the author of the book Killers of the Flower Moon, among others. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you.
In stories of the American Revolution, the Civil War, and westward expansion, the lives and roles of women often go untold. Laramie author Jenny Lawrence is aiming to change that with her book Soap Suds Row, The Bold Lives of Army Laundresses, 1802 to 1876. Caroline Ballard sat down for a conversation with the author about the secret lives of laundresses.
First off, what exactly did an army laundress do?
Army laundresses were the only women recognized by the U.S. Army from 1802 to 1876. Obviously, they did the laundry, and that unto itself was quite the chore, because a lot of them made their own soap, rendered their own lye, washed, ironed. But in addition to that, most of them had families, some quite large families that they tended to. Some of them played the role of midwife. They could wash for officers and their families also, and the officers and their families would pay separately from what the military paid. A lot of them also cooked for officers' wives. Some of them had great knowledge of herbal medicine, natural medicine, and served in that capacity as needed. Took care of livestock if they had a cow to milk or chickens to feed, et cetera, et cetera. And a lot of times, even though we hear a lot about the different classes in the military, if you're the only officer's wife on a post and there's a laundress left behind also, and the men are out on campaign, you're probably going to form some kind of friendship.
And how did you come to this subject?
Well, it's a story. I had a friend who used to go in the elementary schools and present the role of the cavalry here in Wyoming. And he always wanted to do the women's role, but his wife was a school teacher and couldn't break away during her day to do it. And I was self-employed at that time, and she volunteered me and said, I bet Jenny would help you with that. So I started doing that, and it was like a dog with a bone. I just got extremely interested in these women and their life and what they went through and what they did, and just kept going with it.
You acknowledge in the book that it was pretty difficult to find any written accounts of these women. How did you do your research for this book?
Little by little. There's probably 10 years worth of research in here. I did a lot of traveling to various forts from New Mexico, Texas, clear up into Montana, and east also. And wherever I would go, I'd look for information. It's funny, this morning I was cleaning off my desk because my computer crashed and I had to take it in. And then you see how messy things really are. And I found a whole bunch of note cards that had just little jottings here and a little reference there and whatnot. Co-library, the American Heritage Center, I found little tidbits there even.
Was it from journals or from letters? What kinds of resources were you looking at?
A lot of it was from officers' wives' journals. They were educated, and so they wrote about the daily activities that happened. Some references to records that were kept regarding the laundresses, but for the most part, a lot of those were only kept on the company level and were destroyed over the years. You name it, I got my information that way. And of course, now with the internet, that was pretty valuable too.
There are many stories of different women in this book. Do you have a favorite story or a woman maybe that you particularly identify with?
I liked Maggie Flood just because her great-great-grandson, I believe, her great-grandson got a hold of me personally about her and gave me her story. So I really like her.
And she was stationed actually out here in Wyoming.
She was. She was in Cheyenne, Fort McKinney, Fort Laramie. So, yes. And she had a pretty darn tough life. Her first husband was perhaps not the nicest guy from what accounts I have. And he was busted up and down the ranks periodically and whatnot. Eventually, she did divorce him and marry an officer. And the interesting thing about the women who then married officers, it didn't happen very often. And they were not necessarily accepted by the other officers' wives. They were called halfway ladies, which I found very interesting.
One of my favorite stories in reading the book was of a runaway slave couple, Dabney, and his wife, who was a laundress during the Civil War.
Yes. And they were invaluable as spies. She would hang the laundry for the officers and hang it in a certain order. And then he was able to take that information and relay it to his head officer. So they always knew what was going on.
And nobody could really figure out how it was happening
at first, correct? Yeah.
Like Maggie Flood out here in Cheyenne, these women were some of the first non-Native women in the West and in Wyoming at military outposts and forts. What do you think their legacy is?
Just the fact that they were here and they broke the way for other women. These women followed with the troops and were just here. And unfortunately, a lot of people don't realize that Army laundresses even existed, because the ones you always hear about, of course, are the officers' wives, because they kept the journals and the diaries, and they were the ones who had the more famous names, like Elizabeth Custer, and they're the ones that made history. These women were kind of the silent history makers.
Is that why you wrote the book, is to shed a little bit of light?
Yes, it is, as a matter of fact. These women needed to be recognized, and I knew how hard it was for me to find information about them. So as I kept gathering information, eventually my friends encouraged me to write this book, and so I did.
After 1876, the post of laundress was eliminated and civilians or soldiers took over doing the washing. What happened to those women?
If their husbands were still in the military, they were allowed to finish out their term as a laundress along with his term as a soldier. So a lot of them did continue to work. There are accounts clear up into the 1880s of laundresses still receiving various benefits, be it food or housing or something like that. So they just weren't kicked out and said, bye, there you go.
What can we learn from these women?
I think these women at the time could have lived very independent lives if it was necessary. They were tough women, and like many women still are out here in the West, they were survivors. They did what they needed to do to get by and to care for their families. So, you know, we're talking about forgotten women, and no role should ever be forgotten in history. And I think it's important that we pursue it.
Jenny Lawrence is the author of the new book, Soap Suds Row, The Bold Lives of Army Laundresses. Jenny, it was such a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you. I enjoyed being here.
A 2016 documentary tells the biographical story of Clara Brown. She's a former slave who came west and made a fortune. The film Clara, Angel of the Rockies, was a winner of PBS's To the Contrary, All About Women Film Festival in the Women's U.S. History category. Its creator, Patricia McEnroy, grew up in Wyoming and went to Casper College. She joined Caroline Ballard to talk about Clara Brown's life and the documentary.
It's a little more complex than this, but basically he left her freedom in his will. And at that point, she had to leave the state. Because if you were still in this state a year later, you could be put back into slavery, even if you had papers to prove that you'd been given your freedom. So what happened was she thought maybe her daughter was out west somewhere. She knew that people were going west in general. And she went and watched the wagon trains in Kansas City to see, you know, what was going on there. She was really, I think she had a very good intuition about people. And she picked a wagon train that was led by somebody named Colonel Wadsworth. And she told them, I would do the laundry and the cooking, especially for the bachelors who were on the trip, if you take me there. In other words, she didn't have enough money to pay. And he said, okay. So she worked her way across on this wagon train. And then once she got to Colorado, a few things happened, but ultimately she ended up doing a laundry business. There's a lot of single men in the West at this time. You know, and there's a lot of dirty clothes, especially in these mining towns. And so she started doing really well at her business.
Do you know why she's called the Angel of the Rockies?
She would do things like she would make too much food on purpose, and that people were hungry, she would feed them. And so it didn't matter what color they were. She had a spare room in her house. If someone was sick, they could stay there, and she would nurse them back to health. She also would help deliver babies. She was just sort of this kind of person that had that angelic quality. She became the first Black woman to become part of the Colorado Pioneers Association, and they drafted a resolution, and they called her an angel when Clara Brown passed away. And so that might have been part of the way that she got the title.
How did you find Clara Brown's story?
It was a story I hadn't heard until a few years ago. And my partner was bicycling down a bike path, saw one of those, you know, those informational signs they'll have, told me about it. And then I went back and I read the sign and I was like, what? What it was an informational sign on a bike path that said famous people that were buried in a nearby cemetery, which is Riverside Cemetery in Denver, Colorado. And when I read just the paragraph about her, it was sort of like hard to believe because it was such an amazing story. And I went home and I Googled her and I started to look for books on her. And the first book I found was out of print. So I started to think, well, this is a story maybe that's not being shared as much as it could be.
How did you fund this project?
Yeah, it did. It's completely self-funded. You know, I have a background in journalism, and I actually worked at the Casper Star Tribune for some years in the 90s. And so I have the idea of, like, I know what it's like to go out and interview people. That's not usually what I do in my filmmaking. I usually do more, like, experimental filmmaking that's not so straightforward like this. But I just started making a list of, like, who would know her story? Who could I talk to that would know her story? And what I decided to do was just go start talking to them and let them tell her story rather than to have a narration, just to let a group of people tell her story and to thread those together into one common story. Because her appeal is across a wide variety of audiences. And so I wanted to have different ethnicities, different age groups, that kind of thing, telling her story and then weave it together into one piece.
Clara Brown is one person and one person's story from 150 years ago. What relevance does her story have today?
You know, for me, and on a personal level, I'm always looking for role models, you know, and I don't care whether they were born, you know, last year or 150 years ago or 1,000 years ago. I'm looking for role models who are able to overcome a difficulty and come out with a positive attitude. And she's somebody who's like that. So for me, that's really relevant. I think what's also great is that because so many can relate to her story, we start to tie in other historical narratives. So what was it like for someone who was a slave? What was it like for someone who was an ex-slave? It hadn't occurred to me that when someone got out of slavery that they, you know, things weren't immediately better. They didn't usually have a place to go. They usually didn't have a job to go to. A lot of them didn't have family to go to. One of the things we learned from her story is the difficulty of reconnecting with family when your families have been split up. Everyone's got different last names. There's not a good way to communicate, so we don't have internet and telephones at this time. How do you find out where your family members went? It's really word of mouth. We learn about travel at that time. So just getting around first by foot. She goes with a wagon train, like so many people did, and then later she gets to go on a regular train. And all this is before, you know, cars are invented. So by learning one person's story, we learn many, many stories.
Patricia McEnroy is a documentarian. Patricia, thanks so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
We'll be back with a new episode of The Modern West next month. If you like what you hear, we'd appreciate a rating on Apple Podcasts or share a favorite episode with a friend. And in the meantime, you can find lots more stories at our website, themodernwest.org. Taylor Stagner and Lila Kineski produced this podcast. Anna Rader is our web editor. The theme music is by Jeff Troxell, and I'm Micah Schweitzer. The Modern West is a production of Wyoming Public Media.